We don't know who these people were, but we know the Borg destroyed them.
Nothing is more exciting.
We'll simply
have to pay them a visit.
More revealing.
This is only a dream.
You're not dreaming.
And more shocking.
This could be the turning point in our battle against the Borg.
And the explosive season finale.
Their life signs are destabilizing.
Of Star Trek Voyager.
Transfer complete.
Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between the Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, patrolling fluidic space on the other side of the galaxy.
Fancy you mentioned that, because this week we are going to talk about Unimatrix Zero, the Voyager two-parter where the Borg Collective experiences a bit of a glitch.
No, I see this one as the episode in which Seven of Nine discovers online dating.
Well, fair enough. But I mentioned a glitch because some of you may have noticed out there that last week, your podcast feeds may have been inundated with old episodes of the podcast. We experienced some technical issues on our end, and it led to some unforeseen circumstances after much hand-wringing on my part. So I just want to apologize to everyone out there who got that inconvenience happen to them. But it should be smooth sailing going forward.
It happens, Cam.
It does happen.
Yeah, but we appreciate all of our listeners' patience. Hopefully we didn't lose any listeners from this mishap here. So, Cam, this is, I guess, our final Star Trek Voyager cliffhanger. The ongoing journey of the weakening of the Borg.
Yeah.
We can get into that a little bit. But first of all, I want to hear what your initial thoughts were on this episode the first time you ever saw it a few years back.
I mean, okay, so the first time I watched it, I don't know if I had any impressions whatsoever. I feel like I was like, okay, moving on to the next episode. Like, I really didn't get a whole lot out of it. And I think I was really disappointed in the sense of, like, I think at this point I was really worn out on Borg stories on Voyager, but... Even, you know, the Borg weren't really wowing me on Voyager. I had really liked Dark Frontier, which did some really interesting things and actually showed me some things with the Borg I'd never seen before. And so I was like, okay, cool, another Borg two-parter. And it showed me some things I hadn't seen before with the Borg, but not in ways I found particularly interesting at the time.
Okay. Yeah, for me, I watched this as it aired back in the 1990s. Didn't find it to be an exceptional sort of... cliffhanger to cap off the season six going into the final season of Star Trek Voyager. It seemed rather kind of an unexceptional escapade for the crew. I think we can take a look at maybe what they were trying to do with the Borg here. It's interesting to me because Mike Sussman has the story credit on this, and yeah. I think what he did though is he pitched it as a freelancer, and it was essentially a story about a alien culture that is uncovering kind of this collective consciousness. And I think the writers are like, well, what if we applied that to the Borg? Speaking of which, Cam, I don't know if you noticed this sitting across from you here at the recording booth, but I do have my Borg cube ice cube.
Oh, wow.
That is sitting here. It's a pretty big ice cube. I'm going to drop into my glass. Hopefully it doesn't wreck the recording quality going forward. But you would attest to the fact that it's a pretty damn good looking ice cube.
The best of ice cubes.
The best of both ice cubes. Yes. But very well detailed here. So before it melts here in my hands, I'm going to just drop it in. Apologies if there's a clanky noise as I pour my calorie-free sparkling ice.
What a great idea this is for an audio podcast.
I know. I know we're riveting our listeners.
Couldn't have saved it for the YouTube video.
You know what? I say that maybe our listeners are more interested in my ice cube escapades than maybe the episode itself. But here we go. Here we go.
Well, there we have it.
Wow.
I hope that was all you expected.
Well, you know, that said, though, let's get into it a little bit, because this is...
I was more on the edge of my seat watching that ice cube go into the glass than I was the cliffhanger of Unimatrix Zero.
Cam, is this a weird episode to you?
Is it a weird episode?
Not weird as in, like, oh, there's kooky things going on all the time, but weird as in, like, oh, this is what they decide to do as kind of like a last hurrah for the season leading into the final season. Do you think that this was a little underwhelming for many of the fans watching?
Well, it depends. I mean, it is setting up the idea of this Borg civil war, which
pays off quite a bit, right?
You know, looking from the point of view of someone who's maybe watching the finale and the premiere, maybe you're going like, oh, this is really going to dictate where season 7 is going to go. Like, maybe this is really interesting. But I feel like the way it does it is really flat. Like, I just find this two-parter to be just very flat energy-wise and creative inspiration-wise. And it commits a sin that bothers me in ongoing franchises. We've talked about how the Borg petered out at a certain point. And we can never quite pinpoint where. Was it the Borg kids? Maybe. For some people, it's the Borg queen. You know, some people really didn't like the interaction of that idea with the Borg culture. But for me, the creation of Unimatrix Zero, while not offensive on the face of it, feels to me in some ways like a franchise that's gone on too long. Like, I think of, say, like the Halloween franchise, where they introduce like a cult in, you know, the later chapters, or Spider-Man 3, where it's suddenly like, oh, actually, your uncle was killed by the Sandman. It's like they start kind of rewriting mythology to kind of introduce new elements so it doesn't get old, but at the same time, how invested are you at this point?
It's almost as if the writers didn't know how far they could go until they actually hit, like, the low point, where they realize that they're just all out of, like, ingenious ideas.
Yeah.
And I think, from a concept level, it is kind of interesting that you would have these Borg drones that have some sort of mutation that would allow them to have this collective unconsciousness and congregate as individuals. That's an interesting concept.
In an elaborate garden party.
We can get into that that very darkly lit planet in a moment. I think it's an interesting concept, but execution-wise, I kept finding it just very deflated.
Yeah.
Just like as if there's like very little energy. And I was thinking, well, you know, it's the end of the season. I'm sure they're running on gas at this point. You jump into...
No, dilithium crystals.
Apologies, yes. you jump into season 7, episode 1.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels as if they're still, you know, sputtering here. It never really gripped me. I say a big issue was, though, is they eventually, at least in episode 2, and let's tackle it episode by episode, though. But I think by episode 2, we do have a splitting of the crew. We've got Seven doing her own thing. We've got Janeway, Tuvok, and B'Elanna's doing their own thing. And then we've got Tom and Chakotay doing their own thing.
And Neelix doing his own thing
off-screen. I don't know what Neelix is doing in this episode. So, look, this episode had its moments, but I think splitting up the crew lends itself to maybe less interactions within them, and it makes for less interesting, I guess, potential conflict going on.
Well, we've seen in some of the other two-parters from fairly recently covering them, like Equinox or Year of Hell, these two-parters were a great chance to have the characters actually have conflict with one another, which is something Voyager just didn't do very often. It was just not the case with the regular hour-long show very often. But with the two-parters, you tended to get, you know, say, Janeway going head-to-head with Chakotay over a decision or something. And, yeah, you're right. When you do split them up, you kind of lose all that. And so it feels very plot-heavy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, an insane amount of this story hinges on a romance between Seven and this character named Axum.
Who gives Vedic Barayal a run for his money in the charisma department.
Vedic Barayal is doing laps around this guy.
Yeah, yeah. What is the obsession with 1990s Hollywood at the time of casting generic white guys? Like, it's as if they were all born in the same kind of incubator. And they just kind of spread them all around Hollywood and pretty much cast the same generic dude every single episode of every 1990s drama that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, this actor, Mark Deakins, he has been on Star Trek before. He played like a Hirogen Hunter in an episode. Like, he does have some name value within the community of the Star Trek actors. I mean, in terms of who they're hiring from at this point in time.
Has he ever been to a convention that you recall? I don't know about this name value that you're talking about, Cameron. But
I dropped everything I owned on autographs of Mark Deakins.
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, I'm sure he was one of their kind of go-to guys for certain character spots.
You have
spots
an I Heart Mark tattoo on your chest. I can see it.
But, I don't fault them for going, you know what? This guy worked for us a couple times. Let's bring him back, give him a bigger role. But boy, does it not pay off. And I think it's too pivotal a role for where it's taking the character of Seven of Nine. Like, this is her remembering a romance and connecting with this humanity.
Yeah.
And I never believed Axum had any humanity.
No, I know.
He's very, very stolid.
I wonder if our feelings would have changed had the actors had any chemistry.
Yeah.
And they completely lack any sort of chemistry. You really do feel chemistry between, say, Janeway and Chakotay, though. And sure. Whether they go to that well very often on Star Trek, no. But here, it's just kind of like, how can we be invested in two people that feel as if it's almost like kind of like watching high schoolers act out like their senior play or something?
Well, it's very stiff.
It
reminded me of some of the like awkward romance of like Twilight or like, you know, one of those YA movies like Divergent or something.
Yeah.
Where you're just like, ooh, this is awkward. Like, there's moments, you know, where he, like, puts his arm around her, and then it's all awkward. But it's two actors who are in their, early 30s at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, coming across as, like, awkward actors, which is not the most sensational thing to watch on Star Trek.
So from the outset, we have difficulty kind of investing in one of the primary relationships that we are supposed to be interested in here. And yeah. So it has that going against it.
Pivotal, because we're really supposed to be on the side of Axum. I mean, he is this revolutionary within Unimatrix Zero. Like, we want this character to be like the Braveheart of Unimatrix Zero.
Yeah.
And boy, does he not have the charisma to be this sort of leader who can give the speeches that we want to, you know, pump our fists for.
Yeah. So
makes me want to pump the snooze button. Yeah. On my alarm.
so we're introduced to him, and we're in this collective conscious kind of universe.
Right.
Did you ever understand the rules that were going on within this collective consciousness here?
Not really.
Because no. I had the big issue where, like, it is, you know, your mind, right?
Right.
But it seemed as if, like, physical interactions... Let's just get to the point. Like, they would fight Borg drones, and if you were physically hit by a Borg drone, then you would have to disappear from this, you know, collective consciousness. Or if somebody in their brain took a Batleth to a Borg drone, then the Borg drone would disappear. It didn't really make any sense to me.
Is it more that, like, if they have, like, that... You know, there's the old superstition of, like, if you die in your dream, you die in real life. Is it that sort of concept? Like, getting hurt in their dream causes them to snap out of regeneration?
See, you're falling into the trap of trying to, like, retroactively make rules up that they never explained.
I know, they never explained it, but I'm wondering if that's the kind of idea they were going off of.
I don't know. They never explained any of this. So, like the problem is, like, I can't invest in the central location of this either because anything could happen at any moment. None of it really made sense, and I didn't really... care what was going on in this very, very dark planet. You know, like, what was up with, like, the nonstop, like heat lamps that were going on, and, like, it just seemed like this ongoing, like, camping trip that everybody was on for, like, decades.
I love how every time they show, like, kind of like a pleasant folksy area on Star Trek, there's two children chasing each other around within the frame. They always show that.
We got a good chuckle. We were both watching it, and we saw these two children running through the bucolic forest, and we're like, yeah, Star Trek Insurrection,
yeah.
Right? You know, we just need a scene with, like, Brent Spiner popping his head out of the hay. Speaking of Brent Spiner's head, Cam, yeah. I think we also enjoyed the fact that we got a bit of a Brent Spiner cameo in this one, where there were a lot of lobotomies done on Borg drones throughout this, and one of the heads that they got to operate on was, I guess, the mold of a Brent Spiner head. You looked it up. It was originally featured in Data Lore.
Right, yeah, and then reused in Time Zero.
Yeah, so...
And I think we saw it in the ground at the Seattle EMP Star Trek exhibit.
That's right. So...
That head makes the rounds.
You know what? I think what happens, though, is if you are doing a season 6 finale dealing with a Borg, you need to have Brent Spiner involved somehow, right?
I mean,
I'm making a descent.
Did it help this one?
A descent reference. Did it help this one? It was something that I was engaged with ever so briefly, where I struggled to be engaged by other things that were going on. Well, what do you think, though? And this is something that I often... try to stay attuned to when I'm watching these bigger episodes, these more extravagant, kind of adventurous ones. But, like, what is the story they're trying to tell? Like, what are we supposed to take away from it by the end? I think we're supposed to say, like, thematically, it's about, I suppose, romance.
Sure.
It's about sacrifice. I just felt as if everything was a little bit too pat. If we think of this as almost as a caper, let's stick with episode one.
It does have that kind of heist element that you saw in Dark Frontier as well.
Yeah, but wasn't the Dark Frontier one? We did have our criticisms about the 14-minute caper practice session that they did. But I think the caper element there was done far better than this.
Yes, I agree.
This is very, like, I didn't feel as if there were any stakes. It didn't seem as if the characters acted as if there were any stakes. And look, the whole idea was that B'Elanna, Tuvok, and Janeway wanted to get assimilated.
Yeah, which to me seems like an incredibly invasive procedure. I would not be signing up for that one willingly.
Okay, so let's get into that when we get into episode two, because I've got a lot to say on this. But, you know, I with regards to this, I mean, there's a couple... The big thing that I do want to get into is this is kind of the further journey of the Borg becoming lamer and lamer as we go on.
Is this the moment where they jump the shark?
Is this the moment? I think
Dark Frontier... I mean, it's different for every person, obviously. Yeah, but...
Dark Frontier, after we watched it, I think we realized what an underrated gem this is. It's really not talked a lot about in fandom. It has its problems, but...
It doesn't hit the heights of, like, a best of both worlds in terms of being, like, a big blockbuster kind of two-parter, but it's a really strong, I guess, expansion of the mythology of the Borg, I think.
It's one of the darkest episodes of Star Trek. I mean, it's right there in the title, but it is also a small story to a certain degree, which is kind of interesting. I like the fact that they were able to do kind of this feature-length episode, but dig into maybe more of the psyche of a lot of our characters, and we follow it up with this, which I think they wanted to be this giant, huge episode that could rival a Best of Both Worlds. The thing is, we always go back to Best of Both Worlds Part 1, and I think the reason it sticks around with so many fans is you've got the iconic Locutus reveal.
For sure.
But I think the reason fans are so invested in it is because it is very much a character-based episode, and you're invested in what Riker's journey is. And I think a lot of fans also forget that Best of Both Worlds Part 1 is a Riker episode.
Yeah.
So,
and also there's a real sense of building danger in that episode of, like, seeing the aftermath of Borg attacks and things like that. Like, it's more of kind of like the Shark and Jaws idea where it's building so that when you get the Borg actually showing up, there is that kind of like, woof, kind of moment where you just are knocked back by them. At this point, we've seen a lot of Borg episodes, so I think it's impossible for Unimatrix Zero to do that.
Yeah.
But I think they needed to show us something that kind of instilled a little bit of the fear of the Borg. You know, you think of the assimilation chamber sequence in Dark Frontier, which is fantastic. Like, one of the greatest Borg moments across the board in Star Trek. And that sets a pretty high bar. And Unimatrix Zero doesn't really give us anything like that. It gives us some cool stuff with, like, the Borg Queen being assembled. You can tell they're really showing off by this point. Like, look how we can assemble her now.
Well, so this is her third assembling that we've seen in Star Trek. Where would you rank this one?
I mean, the original is so classic for First Contact. This is definitely the most ambitious. I'll say that. Like, they aren't working with the money and the resources that First Contact had, but I really like what they're doing with this one. It looks cool.
Yeah, I would put this number two after First Contact, which I still like the Dark Frontier effect as well.
Yeah.
But
you can tell, like, that's kind of their blockbuster opening, is showing that and, you know, these Borg that are, you know, infected. It's setting up the story in a way where we're seeing the ruthlessness of the Borg Queen and also some, you know, new high-tech stuff we haven't seen with the Borg Queen. It's setting it up in a way that it's saying you're going to see a Borg story you haven't seen before. And it's kind of weird how ambitious that little opening is and how the story itself feels the exact opposite of ambitious.
From both parts one and two, Cam, what is the most memorable sequence in Unimatrix Zero? I'm kind of I'm struggling with this. You know, with Dark Frontier, I would have an easy time telling you the answer. But with this one, I don't know.
I would maybe even just say the sight of seeing Janeway, Tuvok, and B'Elanna Torres as Borg at the end of part one.
I can't argue with that.
Yeah. You know? I feel like that's, if you're going to say there's an iconic moment in Unimatrix Zero, that's probably it.
Okay.
Yeah. But you compare that to the assimilation chamber in Dark Frontier, it's pretty big gulf.
Yeah. So, before we jump over to part two of this, which I think maybe there's a little bit more to talk to, what do you think about, say, Tom Paris getting his promotion?
I was excited to see that.
Yeah.
I was also surprised, looking back at the episode, that they had this moment in an episode that Tom Paris is really not that much of a key factor in.
I would say
he has some moments. Like, he has some moments for sure, but I'm surprised they didn't work this into more of a Tom Paris-centric story episode.
I think, you know, it's the season finale. Let's, you know, true. It's maybe, I don't want to say monumental moment, but
it was a monumental moment when you consider all that was going on in the story.
But I think they wanted to say, hey, you know what? Going into season 7, you're going to have Lieutenant Tom once again. Harry's reaction. Is this just the saddest thing in the world?
Was that our biggest laugh of the episode?
It might have been. But
actually, the setup is pretty great, too, where Tom Paris comes in 22 seconds late and Chakotay is like all over him.
He's literally following him to his console, and Tom is just, like, shaking his boots. He does not know what's going on.
Do you have trouble believing this is how Chakotay would behave if someone was 22 seconds late?
He doesn't like people kissing in the turbo lift.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I'd forgotten that this was the episode where he got his pips.
Yeah, and I didn't remember it either, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was kind of like, you know, Chakotay's being harsh, but we have seen this before.
Is it almost meta commentary on the series itself when we're getting Harry's reaction, though?
Yes. I don't think that line is there if the show is not fully aware that, Ensign Kim is still an ensign.
So why can't they just give him the promotion? They're willing to demote Tom to ensign for a year.
Yeah.
And then promote him again. So I don't know, that the whole syndication argument is all out the window at that point, because that was the argument for a long time. Is, well, you don't want to confuse people if they're catching it five nights a week and they miss, you know, a week in a row.
Right.
I don't know.
But, I mean, does a changing of a rank with a character really confuse people in syndication? Like, do people even really notice?
I think back in the day, the studios would maybe argue that. Yeah. So maybe I'll throw this question at you. Why not just promote Harry at a certain point in the series?
I have absolutely no idea.
I know.
Because in terms of their function on the show, I don't think it's going to change anything.
Is, like, it not frustrating?
Season 7 is not wildly different because Tom Paris is a lieutenant.
And is it wildly different because he's an ensign in Season 6?
No.
Yeah.
No, so, not at all. They're still in those briefing rooms, just the small group of them.
Yeah, which always happened to feature Neelix for some reason. He was a very interesting individual in this one, but
in part one, particularly.
I want to go back to the Harry thing, but let's just discuss Neelix very briefly, because we both noticed
briefly is the key word there.
Briefly with Neelix,
yeah.
Neelix was in the engineering room when they were discussing the plan to jump onto the Borg vessel.
Yeah,
and he was just standing there.
He looked concerned.
Why was the ship's cook standing in engineering planning this caper, and he didn't have a single line?
He just wanted people's lunch menus.
He was there for catering. Yeah. I don't know. It was just bizarre. My suspicion is that maybe they cut a line from Ethan Phillips that was there originally.
He must have had a scene cut. Yeah.
And then, spoiler alert, part two, they throw him behind the console that sits behind Janeway and Chakotay, and he's just reading out sensor readings.
Yeah. He has like three lines, maybe two.
He is the ship's cook.
Yeah.
What is he doing?
Now, do you think they wrote the script and then realized they forgot him?
Yeah.
And they just worked him in that moment?
I guess so, but why not just leave him out of the two-parter altogether? Is it because it's the last episode and the first episode, and
I feel like
fans would feel kind of annoyed that not every single character is featured?
I think you have to have every character somewhat accounted for in these two-parters.
But why not even just give him a moment? Like, even a moment?
But maybe they did and it was cut somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I feel like whatever Neelix had in this episode hit the floor.
Okay. Going back to Harry, though. Is it not frustrating as a viewer, though, where it seems as if the character is in a very static state?
It is, because, you know, we like to see a little bit of journey with these characters, and I understand it's a period where you don't have, you know, that the evolving storylines that you would have on, say, Star Trek Discovery. But it's nice to see little changes here or there. Like, I remember watching The X-Files back in the day obsessively, and, like, just those little twinges were, like, what kept me excited, you know? The changing of Mulder's, you know, confidants who came to him to tell him secret details about the government. Like, things like that. And it's just little cosmetic details like that were enough to give you that boost of energy. And I think it's something that, you know, Star Trek Voyager could use a little bit more of.
You feel more invested in what's going on because it emphasizes to you that what has come before matters and you should continue on with this journey. And I think it was just like this kind of backwards thinking of narrative storytelling back in the day that I think, it's really, I guess you can go to shows like L.A. Law or NYPD Blue
sure.
that really started to push things a little bit. And I wish Star Trek was a little quicker to pick up on that. Certainly they're doing it on Deep Space Nine, though.
But, like, try and justify, like, why is Harry's rank so important to keep the same? But, hey, the Doctor's got a mobile emitter now.
Yeah.
Hey, Seven of Nine's on the show.
Yeah.
You know, the whole syndication concept goes completely out the window at that point.
I'll never understand it. And whatever explanation maybe the head writers would give, I don't think it would be a good explanation at all.
Right. I mean, the Delta Flyer exploded in this two-parter.
Were you devastated?
Well, you know, I did have a little bit of a moment of like, oh, wow, I'd forgotten they made such a momentous decision.
Because I think Delta Flyer A shows up within an episode or two of this.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's kind of like, oh.
Did you ever really develop a connection with the Delta Flyer? Like, did it ever mean anything to you? Because I know when they brought in the Defiant in Deep Space Nine, that was a big deal, and people got really excited about it and were attached to that ship.
Yeah, you know, I totally understand why somebody would be attached to the Delta Flyer, like fans out there.
Yeah.
It didn't really ever do it for me.
Do you think it just lacked moments? Like, they never gave the Delta Flyer, like, really cool moments that became iconic and made you actually have that emotional connection to it.
I'll say this. You know, you do an episode like Alice, for example, which
yeah.
we kind of have kind of the alien who's kind of embodied within it. And maybe you have the race that Tom and B'Elanna were doing. I think it had its moments,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't necessarily stuff that really, like, I was all that invested in.
And it wasn't, like, the big vital moments of the show. It was more like side stories.
Yeah.
You know, you never got to see it pull off a really, really awesome maneuver in a two-parter that really excited people.
Yeah. So, look,
Fine. Like, I don't have anything against it.
But
it never feels like it had the impact it should have.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Cam, any final thoughts on part one before we jump over to part two and dive in?
Well, what did you think of the idea of using this story as a way to tap into sort of Seven's romantic history? Like, did you feel like this was a good idea, or was it almost too much to dig into when you're developing this Borg Civil War? And I know the writers originally were thinking about doing more like a Magnus Hansen reunion, having him be...
The romance? That's disgusting.
Not the romance, but have him be leading the revolution within the Borg, which I think would have had more of an emotional connection as opposed to a forgotten romance.
Sorry, maybe I'm confused, but did Magnus Hansen not get obliterated in Dark Frontier?
I don't really understand.
So I don't think that would really make sense then.
I don't know. That was in the Memory Alpha banks.
You keep going to Memory Alpha, and there's like a lot of stuff in there that doesn't really seem to
That's
make
what
sense.
I thought
to
he'd gotten obliterated too.
My opinion is just because it's Memory Alpha doesn't mean that it's actually true. It all really comes down to execution.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea is good.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't executed very well.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Part two. You know what? Let's talk about the cliffhanger. Janeway, Tuvok, and B'Elanna assimilated. Remember what a big deal it was where Picard was assimilated? And we get to this.
Yeah.
Does it feel nearly as monumentous as what we got with Picard?
No.
Yeah.
Well, you can't replicate the same thing twice.
Yeah.
But
they tried to. Was that just, like, dumb on the part of the writers here?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there is, I guess, a sense of peril to this happening, and I think that was a mistake. Although, it is at the part one, right, where Chakotay says something along the lines of, like, everything is as it should be, or some sort of line like that. Like, he says, it's supposed to happen this way. Kind of like the Doctor Strange in Infinity War type line.
Sure.
Where it's like, you know, there's so many ways that this could happen, or, you know, but only one way will, you know, work in our favor.
Yeah, but, you and I didn't really
tap
into that. It was actually my girlfriend that pointed out to both of us as we walked out of the theater, and we were both like, oh, yeah.
This one was more on the nose.
Yeah.
But it is very much sort of establishing this idea that, you know, don't worry. Which is fine.
And what we do find out later on is that they had a neural suppressant.
Yeah.
Sure.
I love the pseudoscience they throw into these things.
Yeah.
You're like, sure, why not?
Well, so on the surface, is it an interesting idea in which they are infiltrating the Borg by becoming assimilated themselves, but they're doing it by retaining their own individuality while trying to free these Borgs that are individuals within their own collective consciousness. Like, there's multiple layers here. It's kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah.
But again, it just kind of comes down to execution so much. This you said it right at the start. So much of this two-parter just seems so flat to me.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I find myself admiring more the makeup work of Westmore and his team.
Sure.
And just the fun of seeing, you know, characters in costume, which we've talked about in the past. And I think we did a whole episode on that, and I don't even think we mentioned this one. But, you know, I like seeing them made up as Borg. It's fun. It looks cool. But no, you're right. Like, there's no real dramatic heft to it. When you compare Best of Both Worlds, there's a real sense of, like, this could be the end of Picard. And with this one, you're like, they're getting out of it. Because this show is not ending with, like, these three all, you know, in the Borg collective.
Right, and Tom Paris is the new first officer. Anyway.
And Neelix is the ops.
Yeah. Was it jarring to you when Tom came into the office with Chakotay and Tom was like, well, FYI, Chakotay, I am the acting first officer. And I was like, they really must have nobody on this ship.
Yeah.
Just nothing but enlisted people and ensigns.
Well, when he said that, I was like, wait, what? It's like, I never even thought of him as the first officer on the ship at that point. Because, I mean, I feel like, despite being a very plot-heavy two-parter, the show isn't that fascinated in examining the dynamics of having Chakotay and Tom Paris leading the ship, which you look at Best of Both Worlds, which, you know, I hate to keep bringing it up, but when you're doing a Borg two-parter, so much, you know, is obviously evoking Best of Both Worlds. And you look at that Riker-Shelby dynamic on that show with Picard off the ship and how just, like, combustible the drama is. And, like, you want more out of Chakotay and Tom Paris. Like, look at Chakotay.
Out of the two of them, which one is most likely to be an old man's fantasy, Cam? That's a creepy Admiral Hansen reference for all those that might be confused.
Not related to Annika.
No, yeah, it's true. Or maybe it is. I don't know.
That would be amazing. But, yeah, like, I just would have liked more of that character examination with Tom Paris and Chakotay. Like, Tom Paris is known to be a very volatile character at the best of times. And so what happens when he's in a position opposite Chakotay, you know, being the first officer and the captain relationship with B'Elanna in peril? I think that would have been a really interesting look into Tom Paris's maturation as a character, as well as this new rank as lieutenant, like what it means to him. Don't get any of that. I'm just pretty much fan fictioning out at this point.
Did Tom seem all that worried about B'Elanna?
He did seem pretty freaked out about it, but a lot of it is kind of unspoken. He's not actually saying her name or anything like that. Yeah. You just kind of have to read into the scene why he's so upset.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but I would have liked more. It doesn't feel like the type of character drama you can really dig into. It feels like very surface level stuff that you go, he's mad.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing there.
So while we're still talking about the assimilated characters, maybe we'll just jump right to the final scene in the episode where, look, Picard gets an episode to follow up, like, family.
Yeah.
He also gets an entire film dedicated to his trauma from the Borg.
Yeah.
This is never really addressed ever again on Star Trek
Voyager.
Don't
forget, like, I-Borg as well. He's still, pretty traumatized.
You can make the argument, well, there's the neurosuppressant, so that's why Janeway and B'Elanna are doing okay. But what about Tuvok's trauma? Because Tuvok was somebody who even the Doctor explicitly said he's going to take extra time to recover. Tuvok struggled incredibly. He literally was, the neural suppressants failed for him. He's literally an assimilated drone. And I think it's actually intriguing that you can have a Vulcan character who's traumatized this way, and they never did anything with that storyline.
Yeah. Well, you know, Tyler, they did say he would need some extra time.
Oh, okay. So they did address it.
It happened off screen.
Yeah. It's just kind of a bummer, though.
No, I agree. Not a lot's done there. And, you know, it's kind of weird to have, like, Janeway kind of, like, waking up and joking around. Like, well, I guess I won't be at the racquetball court.
No. Was it?
I don't remember what sport.
Hoverball.
Hoverball? Sure,
I know.
But, you know, it's like Picard was going through hell going out of that process. And, yeah, okay, they had the neurosuppressant. Fine. Okay, I can agree that maybe they aren't as, you know, mentally corrupted by the process as Picard was. I can totally go with that. physically, wouldn't this be pretty god-awful?
Wouldn't they be missing limbs or something?
Or just, like, implants where you don't want implants.
Well, we literally saw that moment where they were sticking, like, some implant in Janeway's cranium.
Yeah.
And, like, it went deep in.
Yeah.
I don't think it's just a matter of, like, just plucking it out. I think, I don't know. Like, it just, the physical trauma, if not the mental trauma, seems to be horrible.
Like, to me, that is actually a good reason why we didn't see episodes in the past where characters went undercover as Borg.
Yeah.
Was because the process was so awful, no one wanted to quite go there. Whereas they take it on pretty casually,
yeah,
and walk out of it pretty casually. And that I find very strange. It doesn't feel like that creative decision to go this route was really thought out very well. Like, it doesn't feel like they were thinking of the history of the franchise and going, boy, you know, this Borg process is really, really traumatizing. You know, we just did Dark Frontier, what, like a year or two ago?
Yeah.
And that process looked horrific.
Speaking of history of the franchise when it comes to the Borg, we did get a Wolf359 shout-out.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
Do you think this was a lost opportunity, and stay with me, Cam, a lost opportunity to bring back Jennifer Sisko in the dreamscape here?
I mean, that would have been absolutely amazing. Although, yes, she wasn't turned into a Borg.
How do we know?
Well, I guess that's a good point. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we saw the Saratoga get destroyed, but
yeah.
I don't know, maybe Borg, like, look, Laura, the woman that we did meet who was at Wolf 359.
Right.
She was assimilated somehow.
That's true.
So,
no,
I don't
that's
know.
A good point.
I don't know if that would have been the crossover we've been dying for between DS9 and Voyager. But
that's how you pump your season premiere. The return of Jennifer Sisko, next time on Star Trek Voyager.
I'm just picturing the actress could have gotten, like, so many more autographs at the conventions if she had been able to do that.
Has she even been at a convention?
I've never seen her at any of the
conventions. No, I haven't either.
Have we ever seen Roxanne Dawson at... I was thinking
I
about
have,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, since I've been going, I don't have any recollections.
I think so, yeah. I think maybe 2 years ago, something like that, yeah.
Okay.
She comes a little more irregularly because she works a lot, obviously, directing, so...
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
Their schedule is pretty full.
That's kind of a snippy...
I know. As soon as I said it, I'm like, I feel bad for everyone who's there every year now.
Yeah. No, you know, it's because all the other actors just love Star Trek so much.
That's right. That's right. They're passionate about it.
Yeah. Okay. So part two. Let me ask you this, because we've had a lot of fun with the Borg Queen doing the dance with the Picard.
Yeah.
We got to see in Dark...
the tango.
Yeah, the tango. No, what did he do in Insurrection?
Oh.
Was it the Mamba?
Samba?
Samba? Okay.
I feel like it wasn't the Mambo, because I would say the Mambo. It was, I think, something else.
Okay.
I think it was the Samba.
She's done the dance with Picard in First Contact. We got to see her do the dance with Seven of Nine in Dark Frontier. What do you think the effect of doing this holographic recreation of Janeway and those two were able to go toe-to-toe beyond just a view screen, which is kind of lame?
Yeah, I like the holographic representation, which is a lot cheaper than having her in makeup in all those scenes.
Well, but, you know, like, I do appreciate that, because I think it would actually lose a lot of the dramatic effect if, like, you've got, like, this character covered in, like, Borg prosthetics.
Sure.
Going against another character covered in Borg prosthetics.
Right, right.
So, where would you rank this in terms of the Picard, Seven, Janeway, toe-to-toe with Borg Queen?
I mean, of the three, I think this is the least interesting.
I agree.
I think, actually, honestly, even though Seven of Nine is the primary character facing off against her, the Borg Queen in Dark Frontier, I think Janeway has pretty great stuff in Dark Frontier as well, opposite the Borg Queen. In this case, I just wonder if the fact that the story is hinging on something we don't care that much about,
yeah,
it's tough to get worked up with the fireworks between Janeway and the Borg Queen about what they're actually arguing about. And I think Susanna Thompson's actually really good in this episode. She has great moments going into Unimatrix Zero, for example, and talking to that kid, who I just like to call Billy.
Sure.
You know, and she has that kind of creepy demeanor with him where it's like you can see how she could completely manipulate someone, but we can see that this character is very evil.
I just know you're saying this because at the last convention, Susanna Thompson approached you about a pyramid scheme and you're just...
I gave her all my money.
Throwing cash right at her. So, you know...
People are getting $2 lotto tickets for Christmas this year.
Yeah. No, but she was great.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think she's a bit underrated... for her performance. I said this in Dark Frontier. I think it's a near impossible task to go up against somebody like Alice Krieger, who is so iconic in her turn in First Contact. I think this is like the best thing that we could have ever hoped for, though, is like somebody who really maybe made it her own, but didn't really kind of ruin the Borg Queen for a lot of the viewers, though.
And I like that she made her Borg Queen, or, you know, the writers made her Borg Queen much more like active, where she is the one going out and doing this scout mission on the Unimatrix Zero. She just seems like she has more to do. Whereas,
she's observing lobotomies.
Yeah. And like standing there holding up heads.
Yeah.
Like she seems like she's willing to get her hands dirty. Whereas like the Alice Krieger version always seemed a little more, you know, distant and remote to me. Like she was always just kind of observing everything. And I like that they kind of made a bit of a differentiation between the two just in how they portrayed them on screen. Because, yeah, I mean, you know, the Susanna Thompson character, quote unquote, dies at the end of this two-parter. The next time we see the Borg Queen, it's the Alice Krieger version.
Which it's, I'm still so fascinated by what the Borg Queen represents and how we can like rationalize it and justify it in our own brains. Because we also find out that, well, we have to assume the Borg Queen is telling Billy the truth. I'd like to assume so, but she said, I was about your age when I was assimilated.
Yes.
So what does that mean?
And then, okay, that version of her dies. Yeah. Does that still apply to Alice Krieger when she shows up in Endgame?
So I think I've said this before on the show, but like my brain has to rationalize it as, you know, when a Borg Queen is destroyed, there's another one there to take her place. Like there's another one essentially chambered.
Sure.
And so they have multiple versions, but in my brain, I figured they must kind of be clones to a certain degree. But then we have the Susanna Thompson version and the Alice Krieger version, and they're distinct from one another. But we also know from Endgame that the Alice Krieger version who returns is familiar with Janeway and Seven. And
I can buy that in the sense that, you know, the memories of the collective would be passed on to her. So that I can go with.
It gets a little messy, but I'm down.
So
I'm
was
down.
The Alice Krieger version also assimilated when she was Billy's age?
Well, that's what I'm confused by, because I figured, well, they must kind of be clones or something, or... But I would say Alice Krieger version was not assimilated when she was Billy's age, but the Susanna Thompson version was. So maybe there's an Alice Krieger version that they just keep repeatedly cloning. They get bored with that after a little while. They've got a Susanna Thompson version that they keep repeatedly cloning. They get bored with that after a little while and go back to Alice Krieger. That's the best that I can figure out with the whole Borg Queen concept. I actually kind of like the ambiguity.
Yeah.
It actually makes it more interesting to me.
Yeah, it's more fun.
Yeah.
I do wonder, when the Borg were created at the beginning of Borg time, was the Queen there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you believe that?
I have to believe, in my brain, she's always just kind of been a manifestation of the collective itself.
Right.
So I'd say, yes, she's been there. Although, I remember in Dark Frontier, at least the Susanna Thompson version was established as, I think, species 125.
Yeah.
Which is pretty low, you know, but she wasn't species 001.
The first 124 were like pawn scum.
Okay.
Like, we haven't found a queen yet, sorry.
Invertebrates.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's the fact that there's no definitive answers. I'm actually kind of, I'm happier with this than, like, I don't know, like doing some exposition dump in, like, some episode of Star Trek Discovery, and I'm just like, oh, okay. I'm happier fantasizing in my own brain what this all means versus just having somebody spell it out in like a canon comic book or something.
Sure, you know? Sure. Maybe that's how they should have left the Klingon Ridges thing as well. Something more fun for fans to piece together.
Well, it just means I'm going to have to go lip sync some more pop songs in the corridors of the USS Discovery. A la Mary Chifo.
Do you think it was a mistake to kill the Susanna Thompson Borg Queen and not have her carry into the finale? Because I get it, the finale's a big deal. You want to really go out with guns blazing. But the relationship throughout the course of Voyager with the Borg Queen has been the Susanna Thompson version.
I have an answer for you. This is the feeling that I had back in the day when they announced that Alice Krieger was coming back for the finale. I thought it was a mistake. I thought that by this point in Voyager, this was the definitive Voyager Borg Queen.
Yeah.
And I think Susanna Thompson had actually earned the right to continue on with this. And I kind of think it was a mistake. What are your feelings on this?
No, I feel the same way. I think Voyager should have just owned the Susanna Thompson version. I mean, like, this is our Borg Queen. Because, like, she's introduced really fantastically in Dark Frontier. And to have her go out in this two-parter, which is definitely not high on the ladder of Voyager two-parters, it's kind of like, oh, that was kind of an underwhelming exit. Like, I like her final moment. Like, I think she kills it. She's great. But it's not the triumphant episode you want this character to go out on. Yeah. Not that Endgame is, to my memory, like a huge home run, but it's still, I think, probably better than Unimatrix Zero for sure.
I think there's more memorable events going on definitely. In Endgame than in Unimatrix Zero.
I agree. And I'm definitely very excited to revisit that one as well.
Yeah.
One topic I want to talk about is this whole idea of like a Borg revolution.
Yeah.
Which we would not really see paid off with much, but we saw like seeds of this with like Hugh in like Descent, where like he was introducing these kind of radical elements within the Borg society.
And then
nothing happened.
Yeah.
And look, I can kind of buy it. Even though the Borg's a giant collective, it shouldn't matter. But I can go like in my head and go, okay, well, maybe that's in the Alpha Quadrant. This is in the Delta Quadrant. Like, fine. Even though if they're all connected, it shouldn't should be completely irrelevant. But I'll just go with it for the sake of not being annoyed. Which is fun every now and again. But I do wonder if it's a mistake to approach it this late, where you're getting to season 7, and it doesn't seem like they're that interested in going down that road at all.
I think what the mistake is not when they bring it up, but the fact that they don't address it ever again. I think if you want to bring it up in season 7, it actually makes sense, you know, with regards to the journey that we've had with the Borg. We're getting into the, and no pun intended, we're getting into the end game here. But the very fact is they really don't do anything with it. So, you know, essentially we get to the end of this episode and we know going forward that none of what we saw here actually ultimately matters.
And why do you think they made that decision?
I think maybe they understood this wasn't their strongest effort. And I think it's just easier for the writers to just kind of forget about it, you know, push it under the rug and go on to the next thing that maybe they feel more creatively juiced by another, I don't know, workforce or, you know, flesh and blood. Was that? I always get those mixed up.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. The one with the hologram people. Yeah. Yeah, I think it is flesh and blood. But no, it just seems like such a weird idea to come up with for your two-parter, which is such a pivotal position. Had this been like a mid-season episode or something, I could see them going, yeah, kind of skip over it. But the fact it was your introduction to season 7, it's almost like it's too late to turn around. You'd think they'd have to do something, even if it's just a single episode somewhere.
Or even the finale?
Sure.
And again, the finale is also about weakening the Borg, but in an entirely different way.
Yeah. How many Borg episodes were there in season 7? I know that I'm putting you on the spot. There's not that many, are there?
I can't really think of any beyond Unimatrix Zero and Endgame.
Yeah.
And nothing's jumping out to me. And I look, I'm sure we can find ourselves on Memory Alpha once again and being proven wrong. But that's just naming if there were other Borg episodes, and we can't even think about what they were because they weren't all that memorable.
I do wonder how compelling a Borg revolution story is for them in season 7 after they've killed the Borg Queen. Alice Krieg is not signing on for random episodes through season 7.
Oh no, you just bring back Susanna Thompson again.
I guess, but they blow her up in this one in such spectacular fashion.
No, but they blew her up in Dark Frontier as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's true. Yeah. You know, that's why I say that they always have a Borg Queen chambered.
Yeah. Does it remove consequences though where you can blow up the Borg Queen all these times?
Yes, and that's one of the issues that I have with kind of Voyager's take on the Borg. It's we just kind of see them getting weaker and weaker. The Borg are no longer intimidating. When the Borg show up, I more just kind of shrug my shoulders and be like, Voyager will figure this out. There'll be some, you know, explosions on the bridge, and that's that.
Yeah, it's just really frustrating because I feel like more could have been done if you're going to do a Borg revolution.
Yeah.
And I just think this was a very strange, weirdly slow-paced way to do it. You know, you look at an episode like Redemption, the TNG Klingon story, which sets up like a Klingon Civil War. Like, there's so much more. Like, it's not my favorite two-parter in TNG by any stretch. And, you know, if you listen to our review, I was, you know, maybe a little middle of the road on that one.
But I was a bigger fan. But
you were a bigger fan, yeah, for sure. But you can see there's a lot more intensity to what they're trying to do, and the writers seem legitimately excited about the idea of doing a Klingon war story.
But there are also consequences to what happened there, with Gowron becoming chancellor, and the Duras family being further undercut, and what we find out with Larson Bador, and it goes from there. This doesn't, there's really no follow-up here.
Well, I think you just maybe hit the nail on the head right there with what you just said, is you named off a bunch of Klingon characters who play pivotal roles, and I think they have very strong personalities, and we care about those characters. Even like Larson Bator, who maybe aren't as fleshed out as, you know, say a Gowron or something like that, they're still very iconic, very memorable, and very charismatic characters.
But Axum, Cam...
The most charismatic.
Did you ever want to see Axum return?
No. Yeah. But when you look at the Borg characters, you have your Borg queen, who blows up in every Voyager two-parter.
Yeah.
And then who? Like, you have Axum? But, you know, you don't really have people with really dynamic personalities to latch onto.
That's why I think they should have brought Jennifer Sisko into this. It would have just blown us all away. We'd have been gripped.
Wow.
Yeah. So, any final thoughts before we wrap up? And there's maybe some Discovery news that want to get into.
I mean, just overall, like, I went into this two-parter expecting to really, really dislike it a lot. Like, to be really rolling my eyes at it. But I didn't. I don't even hate this two-parter. I think there's a lot of Voyager episodes I would put lower on the scale than Unimatrix Zero. It just feels so just kind of... I think I can kind of sum it all up with that final moment between Seven of Nine and Axum, where, you know, Unimatrix Zero's collapsing, which I don't really care, and they're saying goodbye, and it's possibly the final time they're ever going to see each other. And I was like, didn't care. Like, I just had zero emotional response to it. And that's damning for when you're doing a two-parter with that kind of story.
And it, as you said, it's not even a two-parter that made me angry or anything.
No.
Like, watching it, it's just like, there's nothing actually exceptionally bad about this one. It was all very middle of the road. Here's what happens. It's over. Okay.
It's like you can tell they had their ideas, but they just never gelled together into something that dynamic.
Yeah.
But, oh well.
Alrighty. Cam, as we wrap that up, let's talk a little bit about some Star Trek Discovery news. Captain Georgiou, or I guess Mirror Universe Emperor Georgiou, there are rumors, and who knows the veracity of this, that she could be getting her own spinoff, CBS All Access.
I like that they announced this like the day after we recorded our episode on Star Trek on streaming.
Yeah, that's true. We both groaned after we saw this. But from your perspective, I think we actually did a video on why Star Trek Section 31 series wouldn't really work, or at least why Section 31 does not need to be explored nearly as much as it seems as if the creative crew wants to do so right now.
Right, yeah.
What was your initial reaction upon hearing word that they're at least exploring the idea of a Georgiou spinoff?
I mean, maybe I was a little primed for it in the sense that there was rumors a little while back, you know, that Harry Mudd was being considered for a spinoff as well. Obviously, there's no sort of announcement whatsoever, but they basically said every character's on the table right now.
Yeah.
And so the idea that Georgiou would be considered, yeah, I believe it. And, you know, Michelle Yeoh is obviously a huge talent. It makes sense in that regard. But in terms of a storytelling...
Is this really something you want to watch?
You know what? I'll say this. To me, it doesn't appeal to me very much.
No.
But when I go through the Facebook feed and look at what people are responding to in regards to this news, everyone seemed very excited, whereas people seemed a lot more down on the other spinoffs that I was excited for. So it's tough for me to say, make the show I want. But I will say, Georgiou is a character... I think works way better, and I referenced Harry Mudd earlier, as a Harry Mudd-like figure who's a wild card who can pop up in the odd episode, contribute an energy that does not exist within your usual crew, and then go off. But the idea of making her a lead of a series to me and tying it all with Section 31 storytelling, which, let's be honest, people, look, I love Section 31 in Deep Space Nine. Has there ever been fascinating Section 31 stories driven by the Section 31 characters?
No.
No, it's all about how it affects the Starfleet characters and how they have to consider bending their dedication to Starfleet values. That's where the drama comes from. It's not from watching a Section 31 operative sneak around in the shadows and like plant a bomb somewhere.
No, and the fact of the matter is, I don't think Emperor Georgiou is somebody that deserves to have her own series. It's not a character that we want to watch week in, week out. Is everyone forgetting the fact that she murders people in cold blood?
Yeah.
Cam, is she a redeemable character to you?
No.
No, she's not. So it's
I mean, it's tough to say in the sense of like, she's very much... Well, I'll say this. Okay. She's very much a product of her environment. And the environment she's from is the Mirror Universe, which obviously follows very different rules than the Prime Universe. And so, like, I can understand how you could chart that character's adjustment to a Prime Universe.
She's a sociopath, yes or no?
So
do you really want to watch a sociopath week in, week out and cheer for the sociopath? As your protagonist, you're supposed to get behind and cheer for them. I can't do this. Like, this, it seems like the dumbest idea, where it's like whoever's pitching it, whoever's behind it, doesn't really seem to understand what Star Trek's about here.
That's the thing right there, as you just said, is that's what Star Trek is about. Yeah. I mean, the idea of a sociopath-driven spy show, that could work. But a Star Trek show that really goes the exact opposite of what you expect or hope to see in Star Trek storytelling, which to me is not driven by this sort of morally very, very murky, you know, kind of behavior.
The other problem is like, let's say there's a non-Section 31 character who somehow...
Like the voice of reason the whole time?
The voice of reason. Is that not going to be the most, I don't know, like, wet blanket of a character you're going to have to listen to every single week? And it's just kind of, like, there's nothing about this series that really makes any sort of dramatic sense. It's going to be us living vicariously through the evil crap that Giorgio is going to be doing while we have a nagging character in the background saying, it's not something we should actually be celebrating here in the Federation, but...
Right.
Yeah, so it's just like, this is not a good idea. Yeah. Just on a conceptual level, it is so misguided.
And the thing is, we don't know if this will happen.
Yeah.
Hollywood loves to announce all these spinoffs / sequels or whatever that are never going to come to fruition. So we'll see, because obviously they're announcing a lot of new Star Trek content, and I suspect more is coming very soon, because we still haven't heard the Starfleet Academy official, you know, launching point. Yeah. But to me, the one thing is, I'm like, if this is going to happen, and it may, I would be maybe a little heartened if I just kind of heard that they were going to start embracing some short form storytelling within Star Trek on the streaming, like
They already have. With a short trek. It's literally called Short Trek, Scam. Where are you at?
I didn't necessarily mean a 15-minute episode, but just the idea of, like, not everything has to be an ongoing series. Like, if they told me, we want to do a 6-episode story about Emperor Giorgio, I'd be like, okay, fine, I'll watch it, I'll see what I think. But if everything has to be an ongoing series of, like, we have to have 13 or 15 episodes and this has to be ongoing, that's to me where... you kind of start to lose me a bit. It's like, yeah. I don't want to have to follow 6, 7, 8 Star Trek shows on the air just because you can launch them.
Yeah.
I would be open, though, if they would do these little curiosity, you know, 4, 6-episode stories, because maybe they can't support a full season, but there's something there the writers want to do.
I think USS Curiosity is, like, the best name of a starship we've yet to get at this point.
That's the other spinoff they're going to announce. Yeah. But no, I think that would be actually really cool, is to kind of fill in some of the shades with characters they feel inspired to tell that story about, but maybe doesn't support a full series, where you're having to sit there and, as you said, come up with convoluted ways of continuing this sort of stretched-out story.
And... this is nothing against Michelle Yeoh. I dug Captain Giorgio. I was a bigger fan of her than you were, but I'd totally be down to watch, like, a Star Trek prequel series following, I don't know, like a Commander Giorgio on the Shenzhou or something like that. Like, I would find that to be a compelling thing to get behind on a limited series basis. Emperor Giorgio doing Section 31 deeds week in, week out. This seems excruciating to me.
Alex Kurtzman loves Section 31 a lot. I mean, I did love Giorgio in The War Without, The War Within, where she had to go undercover as the real Giorgio. Like, that was a blast. But again, it's her bouncing off your normal crew. That's where the fun comes from. Having this character just be the anchor herself of her own series. You don't get that dynamic.
It's going to be a drag to watch.
And I don't want to see, like, Section 31 heads like that guy in Enterprise popping up around. Like, these are not interesting characters.
I would say that I think we've proven it to listeners. You and I have both had very open minds about, like, other spinoff prospects here.
Yeah.
I think we're very much intrigued. I think we're probably more intrigued by Star Trek Lower Decks than we are by Star Trek Picard.
Right.
Just because we found out they want Picard to be an ongoing series, and we're like, oh, really? But yeah. I would say, look,
that may change depending on what they tell me the Picard show's about. At this point, it's such a nebulous thing. You're like, it's a Picard show. It's like, okay.
But look, we have an open mind to these spinoffs. This is the first time where I'm like, oh, guys, I just think that you are on the wrong track here. Like, this is not going to turn out well.
I have a question for you. Yeah. Is there any character you've seen on Discovery yet that you feel warrants a spinoff?
Warrants a spinoff. No, I don't think we've got, like, the real breakout character that would warrant, like, there's characters that I really like, but like, that would warrant a spinoff. Although, if somebody came and told you that, you know, we're going to do a Miles O'Brien spinoff,
yeah,
what would your reaction be?
I'd be like, are you serious?
Yeah. So there's characters on Discovery that I could see, you know, transporting to other series and being, you know, more prominent there.
Yeah.
But, you know, not necessarily headlining something week to week. Who's the closest in your opinion?
That fits a spinoff.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess at this point, maybe like an Ash Tyler Laurel story.
Oh, that sounds...
I know, I'm not saying I'd want to watch it, but it makes the most sense in terms of like the journey they're on.
Yeah.
You could do a separate series about, I don't know, their adventures in Klingon society. And it would be separate from, obviously, where the Discovery crew is going. Like, they feel like they could go in two separate directions.
Sure.
I'm not saying that that's an exciting pitch for a series I want to watch. But
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
I just remember, like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They had, like, these two characters that revitalized the show. Like, they really brought a lot of energy to it. And then ABC got greedy and was like, we're spinning off those two characters into their own show. So the two characters were written out of S.H.I.E.L.D., and then the pilot was never aired. It never went anywhere. And then they never returned to the show.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, that was a great idea.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, if you're going to like spin off Emperor Georgiou into her own thing, maybe we lose like a really great, I don't know, mid-season episode where she pops up as some sort of foil for Burnham and crew for an episode.
I think at this point, Emperor Georgiou should just be the occasional, you know, antagonist that shows up, you know, once or twice a season. Their version of Q.
Sure.
I don't need her. I don't need
That's
to see.
That's actually a great idea.
Yeah. I just don't need to see a sociopathic character on the road to redemption, you know, like every single
week. You get enough of that dealing with me.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cam, we are doing the evolution of the Dominion. We're going to do a DS9-centric episode. We're going to be tackling this one because I think by now we're actually hoping we would have been able to see the What We Left Behind documentary that's been promised to us for quite some time.
Did you hear any buzz coming out of Destination Las Vegas? London, I should say.
There's a screening in London. There's also a screening in L.A.
Yeah.
Reviews, people liked it. But,
okay,
I mean, the people that saw the screening, they're all Star Trek fans or Star Trek actors. So I don't think they're going to, like, S-talk it or anything like that.
Right.
So I want to see this documentary. I am waiting in anticipation. We're hoping...
It's not going to be by the end of the year. No way.
Well, they've promise that like we'll at least get like a streaming version by the end of the year, but I'm still skeptical of that.
It's getting close to the holidays, though. They're not gonna want this thing out at the holidays.
I know,
because you want to get some sort of ink, right?
Yeah. So okay, so in lieu of doing a review of this documentary, we are still tackling DS9 hard with the evolution of the Dominion. It's exactly what it sounds like. Go back to our other episodes, like Evolution of the Borg or Evolution of the Klingons, to kind of get an idea of what we're going to be tackling here. But if anyone's interested about how this big antagonist for Star Trek Deep Space Nine really transformed both throughout the run in the series, as well as how they had big influence on the series, this will be the podcast for you.
Okay. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Voke spinoff for the win, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's REPORTON, N as in neural suppressant.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.